At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and FilmIntuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. A film critic for publications such as LA Weekly, New York Magazine, Vulture, The New York Times, and formerly The Village Voice, the brilliant Bilga Ibiri is one of my favorite journalists working today. Additionally, he is a writer-director who's known for the films New Guy, Purse Snatcher, and for assistant directing The Barber of Siberia. Well, Bilga, I want to thank you so much for coming back. It's always such a pleasure. You're one of my favorite people to talk about movies with. And so it's just a joy. How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I am doing well. Yeah, it's kind of a busy week, crazy week, dead cars and appointments and just so much going on. How about you? Lots of deadlines?
Lots of deadlines, you know, some of it self-inflicted. I mean, they're not really deadlines anymore because I've blown them all. So at this point, like the deadline, I always think of as something in the future. Once I miss the deadline, it's something else. So it's really a bunch
to-do
of things.
List.
It's a bunch of things that were due a variety of periods ago, some days ago, some weeks ago, some months ago, and a couple due today that I haven't done yet.
Okay.
Even though it's the middle of the night. But yeah, you know, it is what it is. It's also the busy, it's silly season for critics. The award stuff.
Yeah, we have to watch like so many heavy movies in a row, back to back. It's a lot. And then you get invited on a podcast and all these movies are heavy. And it's like, oh, man. No.
Well, it's a lot of, you know, because it's award season, everybody wants you to see their films before you vote for it as critics. Mm-hmm. But then there's like the stuff you have to write about. And also because it's the end of the year, everybody wants like the think pieces and the what about this and about this trend and about that trend. And I'm like, you realize to write about that trend, I have to watch like 10 movies and read like hundreds of pages of stuff. Like it's not something that happens automatically, you know, or someone will be like, hey, do you want to interview this person like in 2 days? And I'm like, no, like I would love to interview that person, but I can't get ready for an interview in 2 days, you know?
No, you want to prepare, you want to see the movie. Exactly.
Yeah. Or they'll be like, but you asked like months ago if you could interview them. I'm like, yeah, but you didn't tell me I could. I'm not going to do like a ton of research for an interview that's not going to happen, you know?
Yeah.
I get a lot of that, you know, where it's like, oh, this thing that I thought we weren't doing, we're now doing, and I'm totally unprepared.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, talking about awards movies and an actor who's been in a lot of these movies, and sometimes there were controversies around some of these movies close to awards time. I'm sure we're going to reference some of that. But when we were thinking of an actor to discuss, you came up with Russell Crowe. I want to say maybe it was one we threw out a while ago. I can't remember. We have a lot of ideas, Bilga, that I've been writing down.
Was it my idea?
Was it? Or maybe, I can't remember. We go back and forth. We still need to do our Gerard Butler episode. Listeners,
I know,
that's coming.
And I feel very ashamed that I did a podcast with someone else about Gerard Butler.
Okay.
I'm happy to do one with you as well, but it felt like a little bit of a betrayal.
Well, 25 or 26, but we also have a million people to talk about.
Den of Thieves 2 Pantera is coming out soon, and you know it'll be a natural opportunity to talk Jerry Butler.
There you go. Some Jerry. Yes. But we're talking about Russell Crowe today. So what is it about Russell Crowe? Do you remember the first thing that you saw him in or when he actually made an impact and you were like, whoa, who am I watching?
I mean, I in Proof, actually, which is one of the films we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I mean, Proof was one of those films. It was, you know, an Australian production. It was very successful over there, came to the U.S. and was kind of a small art house hit. And it's such a modest little movie in certain ways that I always think of it as a very small movie, but it was a big movie in Australia, as I understand. And it's funny, I was reading an article about Russell Crowe. I was reading one of those articles that was written kind of earlier in his career when he had kind of become a bigger star. And, you know, it was talking about how intense he is and how masculine he is. And I mean, this was written like in the heart of the sort of gladiator, beautiful mind, Cinderella man period, master and commander. I can't remember who'd written the piece. It might've been Manuela Dargis actually. But it was a consideration of him as kind of this masculine avatar and this very intense persona. And it made the point that, while Proof was actually kind of a breakout role for him, I believe he won an award in Australia for it.
Supporting actor, yeah. I think. Yeah.
But he's in some ways the least memorable aspect of the movie. I mean,
he really is. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he's such a kind of very mild, affable, slightly lost, very kind of normie kind of character. It's funny because the film, you know, sort of turns between these two kind of, you know, high pressure extremes of Hugo Weaving and Genevieve Picot's characters, right, who are both very, very odd characters. He's a blind photographer with like a massive chip on his shoulder, and his housekeeper, who is like in love with him, sort of, but is also maybe obsessed with him and has this like
in a weird, dark,
sadistic relationship with him. And he's paranoid, she's sadistic, and Russell Crowe is just like this
kind
waiter that gets caught in the middle of it. But I remember, like, I remember Proof. I remember him in Proof, but I didn't walk away from Proof saying, "Oh my God, who was that guy?"
No, no.
It was later when I saw, I think when I saw Romper Stomper, I don't think
made
I even
a
made
year
the connection.
Later. Yeah.
Like, I don't think I made the connection between like the crazy, charismatic, you know, neo-Nazi skinhead in Romper Stomper with the guy in Proof.
Yeah, Proof. Yeah.
But somebody at some point mentioned that, either in an article or somebody mentioned it, and I was like, that's that guy? You know, like, and that's something I was like, oh, this actor has range. And then, I mean, not long after that, he was in, I remember the Denzel Washington movie Virtuosity.
That's where I first, saw him. Like, I think I'd seen Proof and Romper Stomper, actually. I know I did, on video in the early 90s. I rented everything. And same thing. I thought, you know, those were powerful films, but Virtuosity, I remember going to see it and thinking, who is that? Yeah, there's something interesting. And then Quick and the Dead, I think, was also 95, like right around there.
Right. Are they the same year?
I think so.
I think so. Because I think Sharon Stone brings Russell Crowe to the U.S.
She did. She fought for him and DiCaprio to be in that film.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I think I saw Quick and the Dead later. Like, I don't think I saw it when it came out, despite being a Sam Raimi fan. But that movie wasn't in theaters for long. It was not.
I saw it, but I'm a weirdo. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I
westerns. Yeah.
But I did see Virtuosity, which I thought was terrible. I still do.
Oh yeah,
not like Virtuosity
not a great picture. No.
There is this sort of slowly growing community of Virtuosity stans on Twitter, and it might be the thing that makes me finally leave Twitter. I'm just like, I
know
can't.
People just keep popping up for some of these movies, and you're like, it's not that great, you guys. Yes.
And it's funny because I know that in many cases I am that guy with like weird movies that everyone's dismissed that like somebody's out there making a case for. But then there's certain movies that I'm like, listen, even
it's
I can't
good.
Do this one.
Yeah.
But so that was my, and then, you know, it's weird because it feels like he was a star for a long time, right? Because these films were so big and so kind of weighty. And he very quickly gained this reputation of being basically like the greatest actor of his generation. But really, it was a very brief period when we had like the reign of Russell Crowe, right? I mean, L.A. Confidential is 97, right?
Yes.
He's in that. Obviously, there's The Insider in 99.
Mm-hmm.
It's so wild to me still that, and I know we're going to talk about both these movies. It's so wild to me that The Insider is before Gladiator.
It really is. Yeah, he really went for it.
But also like in like The Insider, obviously he's playing kind of doughy older man. And then, you know, within a few months, he's like totally ripped as Maximus in Gladiator. But what happens is, I mean, first of all, he's really good in The Insider, but also The Insider has the feel of an actor doing a part that's going to somehow like bring him back into the fold. There is a kind of like it feels like there's something wrong. It's like a glitch in the Matrix that The Insider is 1999. I feel like that's the movie he would have done in like 2010, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
But anyway,
kind of around the 310 to Yuma era. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So there's
Body of Lies around there.
Right. So there's really just a 5 or 6 year period when Russell Crowe is kind of at the top of the world, it feels like.
Yeah.
And then after that, he's obviously still around. He works a ton, but you know, that kind of, it's not a period of decline. Like it's not like he doesn't give good performances. From what I understand, he himself was kind of like, enough. Like,
yes.
I don't want to do these like huge things where I'm off for a year, you know, getting ready and doing these massive, massive parts.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the movies that did launch him, those early ones, Proof and Romper Stomper, are well worth checking out. I can't remember exactly where. I mean, when you're listening to this, you can track it down with the Just Watch app or through a Google search. But I think Romper Stomper was on Canopy and Proof was on Hoopla, but I think it's also on Peacock, I believe.
Yes, I believe they're both on Peacock.
Okay.
I rewatched Proof on Peacock and
okay.
Very, very pleasant to discover that it wasn't something I had to, you know,
rent,
through commercials or.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Know.
It is. It's like one of those movies I probably should have bought on DVD at some point, but for some reason didn't. But it is it's a lovely movie, and it's really, I'd be curious what people think of a movie like that today, because it's
yes.
a film that presents these not very likable characters.
No, not at all. Yeah, I think Australian cinema was kind of going for it in an interesting way. Like some of the Gillian Armstrong and some of the movies that were like a decade earlier, and now we had Jocelyn Morehouse. And yeah, I think that is interesting. We kind of had the cult of likability, although in the 90s with the independent movies, you know, anything went there for a while, but we aren't making movies like this at all anymore. And so it would be interesting if someone watches it for the first time. Or someone who only knows of Jocelyn Morehouse from like How to Make an American Quilt and then goes back and watches Proof. Yes.
Yeah. And I remember being like after this movie, being a huge Jocelyn Morehouse fan, and I loved How to Make an American Quilt.
Me too. Yeah.
But over the years, you know, I feel like she just hasn't gotten the kinds of opportunities.
Oh, no, The Dressmaker really was pretty bad. Yeah.
I liked The Dressmaker.
Oh, you did? Oh,
I did like The Dressmaker.
The performance was good by Winslet. Yeah.
Yeah. And Judy Davis was fantastic.
Yeah. She's always great.
Yeah. I did like The Dressmaker. But like, I just discovered that like she made a movie, was it this year? One of these kind of elderly actresses get together movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like a film that was kind of discussed and then dismissed. I didn't realize she'd done it. Like I was looking over her filmography, and I was like, wait, that was a Jocelyn Morehouse film? I would have watched it, you know?
Oh, wow. Okay. But and then Romper Stomper, totally left field performance there. Could not be more different from Proof. You know, this was a shocking one. I just talked about American History X with Roxana Hadadi, Edward Norton's performance a few weeks ago or last month. And but this one is far more frenetic. It's kind of like the beginning of American History X, but like sustained. It's a crazy film. I don't know that the whole movie really fully works, but the performances are really powerful. Yeah.
It's been a while since I've seen Romper Stomper, but I remember being really shaken by it, but also having a lot of issues with just it as a, you know, I didn't think it was that good a film, but it's like one of those films that like really makes an impression on you just because it's so kind of aggressive and, you know, stylized, and obviously because of the subject matter. But it is interesting, that type of film. I mean, with that subject matter, you know, every few years you get one of those films, right? You get like,
yes,
American History X, you mentioned. You
The
get
Believer was the one
There's
with
The
Gosling.
Believer.
Yeah.
There was Costa Gavras's Betrayed from the
Oh,
late
yes.
80s, which I really love. And then there was that film a few years ago with Daniel Radcliffe, right?
Oh, yes, you're
Remember,
right. Yeah.
I reviewed it. I remember what it's called. Which was like not, was it, what did I think of it? I reviewed, I can't remember what I thought of it. I think I was kind of mixed on it. I don't quite remember.
Yeah.
But now we're getting The Order, which isn't out yet, but is coming out, you know, this award season, with Nicholas Hoult as a white supremacist and Jude Law as the Fed trying to take him down. It's kind of like, I mean, I've described it to people as Heat with white supremacists. I think it's a really good film.
Okay.
But it is interesting, like every few years we get the white supremacist pop culture check-in, and it's like, it never really winds up being a discussion about the film. It winds up becoming, where are we in our current historical trajectory? Like, the films themselves can be good or bad or indifferent or interesting or whatever, but then it's like, so quickly you go from thinking about the film itself to your relationship as a person in actual like historical time with that film.
Yes. Watching Romper Stomper again now in 2024 after the election was eerie, because some of the arguments these guys are making, you're like, well, they just say that now on the news. Yeah.
I remember when Costa Gavras's Betrayed came out in the 80s. I mean, that was a film that critics did not like, and a lot of people just dismissed it as kind of this is a ridiculous subject to be making a film about. And
that's the one with Deborah Winger.
Tom Berenger is like the white supremacist, and
I actually think it's a very entertaining movie. It's a little ridiculous, but it's entertaining. Yeah,
I love it, and I'm like, actually, I think that movie holds up a lot better than a lot of films that seemed far more topical and restrained did back then. But anyway, Russell Crowe wasn't in that one.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Romper Stomper adjacent is what we're saying.
Yeah.
And then in the mid-90s, of course, we talked about Virtuosity, Quick and the Dead, and L.A. Confidential is the movie that put him on the map. I actually remember the press tour for L.A. Confidential, and one of the funniest things I still remember was seeing Alec Baldwin on the Rosie O'Donnell show, and he kept like cracking jokes about how Kim Basinger was so charmed by her co-star. And so he was like doing an impression of her at dinner. Oh, Russell said the funniest thing today. And like then Baldwin kept going, oh, did Russell? Like it was just how charming this guy was. And then Rosie and other people, and through the entire tour, they were like, this guy is going to, you're all going to fall in love with this guy in this movie. And so I remember when we saw it on opening night, we drove a little bit far, and we actually saw it at like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. So we got out really late. And yes, that was, you know, also Guy Pearce, I remember being blown away by it. But yeah, it was such a potent performance. And I think that's the thing that really everybody all of a sudden was, you know, on ready to go to bat for Russell Crowe. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, he really jumped out in that film as well. Although at that point, you know, we kind of had some idea of him as a very intense actor. You know, I'm not the world's biggest fan of L.A. Confidential. And I always thought, I was like, oh, maybe I just didn't see it in the right mood. I watched it again couple of years ago, and I was like, yeah, I'm still not entirely on board with this movie.
The ending for me I feel like it goes on too long. That's my big issue.
Definitely. I mean, that's definitely part of the issue. But I think, like, tonally, the film is kind of a little all over the map. And also psychologically, it requires Russell Crowe's character to sort of, like, I don't think they've entirely established his psychology, because the plot requires him to fly off the handle in situations where I'm like, I'm not entirely buying it. And it's not because of the performance. I actually think, I mean, this is a movie that everyone loves and everyone talks about how it should have beaten Titanic, about how it has a perfect script. I think the script is a problem with that movie. I mean, it's not a bad film. Like, I can watch it again, but I think it's kind of a, you know, I'm a little mid on it, and it is interesting, because at the time I thought to myself, I was not a particularly big Kevin Spacey fan, and I'm not saying that now because he's, like, been deemed a bad person, but he was always one of those actors where I was like, there's just, like, it never quite feels like I'm just
a little
never
self-conscious. Is that kind of
self-conscious? And there's just something, a kind of very middling quality to
okay.
a lot of movies. Some of it was just the fact that he was often cast in these very middle brow, American Beauty and stuff. But I did think at that point, because I hadn't liked Virtuosity very much, I was like, oh, is Russell Crowe going to be one of those actors that I just don't like? You know, like, is he going to be one of those actors who just, like, shows up in a movie and I'm like, oh, God, you know.
That guy.
Yeah. So it was interesting that he kind of became who he became, you know.
Yes.
Like, he became undeniable.
Yeah.
As an actor, you know.
Yes. Well, I'm a huge fan of The Insider. I think it's one of the best films of 99. Speaking of up against another Kevin Spacey movie, American Beauty, of course. But The Insider, Michael Mann, when I mention this film, so many people jump out and they're like, this is the best Michael Mann movie. I disagree, but I think it's in, like, the top five. Although, if we're talking about Michael Mann, you know, those can cycle different numbers every day, pretty much. But I love this film. I love what it says about journalism, about whistleblowers. I love that there's a dueling fax machine sequence that's so thrilling and exciting, and you're like, you miss the fax machine. It's a really good performance by Al Pacino in an era where we were kind of, like, getting a lot of the post Son of a Woman type of Al Pacino performances. So, yeah, I love this one. They gave Diane Venora better hair than she has in Heat, thank goodness. She's great. Yeah, I think this is a really good film. Did you love it right away?
I love The Insider. I mean, I've talked about it endlessly on all sorts of podcasts because of the whole Michael Mann thing. I did like The Insider a lot when it came out. I mean, I've talked about this before on, like, Blake's podcasts, but, you know, I wasn't, like, entirely sold on Michael Mann, you know, kind of in the early 90s. And I mean, I liked Heat at the time. Now I think Heat is one of the all time greatest films.
I agree. It grew on me more the more I watched it.
Mm-hmm. I think it does. I think it did for a lot of people, because it's designed to not really quite be the movie you're expecting it to be. I mean, it delivers on a lot of those fronts, but then it does so much more that at the time, you know, I mean, I've talked about this too, but, you know, Whit Stillman has this thing that he mentioned on the Cows in the Field podcast that I really love. He was talking about The Last Days of Disco and kind of how it wasn't a particularly big hit when it came out. And he talked about the movie's not normalness. Like, he's just talking about movies that are not normal. And so when they first come out, there is this weird, like, they exist in this context of this is the new movie, and it kind of exists within the context of that moment. And it's like almost a subconscious thing. Even those of us who are trying not to do that wind up doing it. You wind up judging it based on all these factors that have more to do with, like, the types of movies that are coming out at that particular moment.
Yes, that's
or
true.
That you've seen, you know, that year or whatever. And like, for whatever reason, these movies are often deemed lacking or not quite there, or, you know, moderately successful or whatever, or problematic in some way. And then 10 years later, you're like, what the hell did I ever think was wrong with this movie? It's one of them, you know? Or, like, it's so crazy. And it's like, well, yes, it's crazy, but that's what's great about it. I mean,
yeah,
you know, I mean, there's so many films I've listed these in the past, but like Bram Stoker's Dracula is a perfect example of that, right? For it comes out and everybody's like, what the hell is this? And now it's like, how could we ever have not recognized that this being so special? Or I don't know, in my mind, Tenet is one of those movies where I'm like, what else do you want? Like, it's completely daring. Like, it's like nothing you've seen before, you know? And Heat was a bit like that, right? I mean, it was just like so ambitious and so overarching in its kind of Dickensian expansiveness. And at the time I was kind of like, why are we wasting our time with all this stuff? And now I'm like, oh my God, I was an idiot for thinking that. But The Insider was one of those movies where, like, all right, this time he got it. This time Michael Mann nailed it, you know? You know, I mean, as you say, it has two great performances. Aiding to is to look at Heat and The Insider as, you know, because there are two movies he makes back to back. I mean, not back to back.
Yeah.
One is 95, the other is 99. But those are the two movies he does consecutively. And they have similar structures, right?
I mean, yes.
Both are basically about two people who are, for the most part, in separate places, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not. I mean, obviously, in Heat, it's like a big deal when they finally come together because it's De Niro and Pacino.
Yeah.
But like in The Insider, they're also often separate. I mean, they come together every once in a while, but really, what's happening is like one is having this a particular character trajectory, and the other is having another particular character trajectory, and it's all happening within the context of this overarching story, but the way Mann loves to play these characters off one another,
mm-hmm.
obviously in Heat, it's the cat and mouse story. So it's, you know, one guy is chasing the other. And in The Insider, one guy's, you know, initially kind of chasing the other, and then they're working together ostensibly. But they are temperamentally two completely different people. And, you know, when you watch... I mean, and the way Mann cuts between them, I mean, you can sense that he's drawing attention to these contrasts in their characters. You know,
mm-hmm.
you see Al Pacino's Lowell Bergman in kind of these situations where he's living on the edge, as Mann characters like to say. He's living on
yes.
the edge, and he's in many ways a very free man, right? He's mm-hmm. he's doing what he loves, and he has this kind of inner aggression that makes him go out and achieve things, right? And there's little
yep.
scenes where he talks about his past and his kind of counterculture roots and things like that. And then you have Russell Crowe's character, who is, I mean, this is a man who doesn't have any kind of freedom all throughout the film. I mean, he trades one kind of unfreedom for another, really.
Mm-hmm.
But he is, you know, completely kind of submerged in this office where he's leaving. I mean, he's been fired. Ironically enough, at the end of the movie, it's like there's this parallelism that happens with, or this parallel that happens between him and Pacino's character, because at the end, Pacino leaves his job and kind of steps out into the light the way Russell Crowe does. But he, you know, Jeffrey Wigand, you know, he loses his job, and so much of his job is really about providing for his family and about, you know,
yes,
making, yes, yep. health insurance for his kids. And, you know, they go out of their way in the film to show that one of his daughters has asthma. So it's like, you know, and it's
yeah.
funny, because my son had asthma when he was younger, and it can be scary, but it's so rarely that like frantic and urgent pulling out the things. It's like, you've got your albuterol ready for whenever they need it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's not that like freak out of a situation, but it can be scary. And
it sets the tone though, that this is a man
right.
who everything is coming down on him. Yeah.
Yeah. It creates
yeah.
this kind of urgency, and it also
yeah.
creates a kind of,
because he has a lot of anxiety, and he's a little volatile and unstable, and but he's a good man, and he wants to share something that he knows is wrong. Yeah,
yeah, and also it also, I think, importantly establishes some context for Diane Venora's character, who is
yes.
you know, let's face it, one of the all-time unsupportive spouses in movie history.
Yeah, she's kind of a wet blanket.
But in both cases, you know, Dave, you know, man makes sure to create, you know, give us the reasons why she's like this.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, and obviously there's a certain amount of like she's used to a certain a comfortable life and these kind of nice big houses that they have. And, you know, there's that scene later on where she's yelling at him for like washing his hands in the sink. And, you know, and it's.
Yes. And it's you're bringing this into our house. You're bringing this into my space, our domain. Yeah. It's one of those conversations that's about something else. Yeah.
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 And it's but, you know, because she's like so clearly, you know, worried for their daughter.
Yeah.
Health insurance and things like that.
Like you get it. Important. Yeah.
Right. And but like there is already that tension. I mean, when he says that he's been fired, first he doesn't say it to her.
Yes.
And then he reveals it to her. And the first thing she wants to know about is like, you know, what will happen to them financially. There's no, oh my God, I'm so sorry. You know?
Yeah.
and he's obviously embittered by that. So, you know, you understand the nature of their relationship. But what's the genius of the casting here, though, is Crow is, even at this point, such a kind of intense actor and has a reputation for being an intense actor, that to see him play this kind of very doughy, you know, milquetoasty kind of character, there is still this edge of, like, this guy could lose it at any moment. And it's not a kind of...
Yeah,
like it's not quite like, I think it would be kind of different if he did this movie 2 years later, because after he'd done like Gladiator and stuff, because you'd be kind of anticipating it. It's not so much the promise of a blow up, but the possibility of one. And he really kind of this sense that this is a person who has internalized everything.
Yes.
And generally speaking, people who internalize everything eventually have to externalize it.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, that's, I think, the beauty of casting Crow in that part. And he's so good in it. I mean, he actually does look like what Russell Crowe kind of looked like, you know, in it, you know, when he got older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is such a strong and unexpected performance. I mean, we know he's a great actor, but it isn't really a part like, you know, you could have maybe seen, to use Heat or something, somebody like Val Kilmer taking on that role at that stage of his career. But coming up through like LA Confidential and some of the, like, he wasn't going for these Bourne Identity type roles then. He really was about the work and wanting to kind of dig in and do these character parts. And I think, yeah, it's a fascinating one. And it is interesting then that he goes over and does Gladiator right after that. This was around the time of course, the big tabloids and Proof of Life and how that movie was kind of, and I think it's actually a very good movie. I think David Morse and David Caruso kind of steal that movie over Russell Crowe. Unfortunately, everything that happened with him and Meg Ryan kind of like weighed on that film, unfortunately, but I do think it's good. But, you know, seeing The Insider and then seeing Gladiator, it does feel like they are out of time, that Gladiator should be first. Gladiator is a film where it's kind of maybe like you with LA Confidential, although I don't know your relationship to Gladiator, where I like the film. I think it's very good. It's beautifully shot. The cinematography is amazing. The music is like my favorite. Good performances. I think Joaquin Phoenix kind of steals it. But I don't love it the way that other people love this movie. Although, you know, it is a strong performance. Yeah. How do you feel about Gladiator?
I love Gladiator. I remember when Gladiator first came out, I really liked it, but I had two problems with it, which was, one, I thought it was like gratuitously gory. And I don't mean like gratuitously gory and like I don't have a problem with screen violence at all.
No, no.
But it was just like there were certain scenes where it's just kind of just a little too indulging in the bloodshed.
Relishes in it. Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, when you look back at it, I mean, obviously that's kind of part of the point of the film. But that stuff took me out of the movie a little bit at the time. And then the other one, it's funny to say this now, is that I thought Joaquin Phoenix's performance in that movie at the time was terrible. I mean, he got nominated for an Oscar for it, and
And you're like, who is this guy?
set
Come on.
himself off on the road to being like one of our great actors, and has had a reign longer than Russell Crowe, arguably. But at the time, I was just like, this is too much. This is too much. Like, I'm just
Too
like,
much method actory kind of thing. It's the Joaquin Phoenix,
I mean, it was weird because I was watching it and thinking to myself at the time, I feel like there's just a fundamental imbalance here because he's giving this kind of very sort of flamboyant performance where I mean, he's basically a snarling villain. And I was just like, I don't need the movie to spell out everything in that way
Yeah, I
at the
agree with
time.
you a little bit at the time. I think some of that is the script, though, for sure.
Yeah, some of that is the script. I mean, it's, in so many ways, when I look at a movie like, oh, say, Gladiator 2,
I have
can
not seen
appreciate Gladiator more.
it yet.
Or for that matter, Napoleon. But it is,
Yes.
I think at the time, again, this is you watch a film in the context in which it comes up, because at the time I thought of Gladiator as more of a prestige movie than it actually was and is, because of, because it was Ridley Scott. Like, Ridley Scott was, I mean, Ridley Scott was an artist. I mean, still is,
Oh,
but
for
like back
sure.
then, it was like Ridley Scott had done Blade Runner and he'd done Alien. And like his films tended to err on the side of artistry over, schlock, let's say. Right. I mean, he was not, ironically enough, Tony Scott was more of a schlockmeister in a weird
It's
way.
kind of like he did a Tony Scott, or that's what it felt like at the time. And it was coming after Braveheart, which I love, although that movie gets a little too gory.
I love Braveheart. No, I love Braveheart.
I love that film. See, that's my, like, if of that era, I'm like the Braveheart person.
Well, the thing about Braveheart is there is obviously all sorts of horrific bloodshed in Braveheart, but it's happening to people we care about. And that's the thing with Gladiator. It was often just like, it's just like
Let's show it.
random people just getting slaughtered. And it's kind of like, this isn't, whereas with Braveheart, I mean, when they
Oh
cut,
my goodness. Horrific.
girl's throat, it's just like, holy
Or
shit.
the stretching at the end. I mean,
Oh,
oh, yeah.
yeah. But, I mean, today I look back on Braveheart and Gladiator almost as kind of, a tandem. I mean, there are lots of films in that period. I mean, there is this, I would argue, that there is kind of a period of, avoid the repetition, an era of period action that we get starting in the early 90s. I mean, I like to think of Last of the Mohicans as being the one that started it, but it's probably not the, like, it was kind of bubbling up in the air.
Yeah, we had the Robin Hood and the all of those films.
Yeah, we get, the Kevin Costner Robin Hood,
Rob
obviously.
Roy and First
And then,
Night and all of
like First Night's the flop, but First Night is
them.
actually, I
I
really like
enjoy
First
it,
Night.
but
I
yeah,
love First Night. We should do a
exactly.
Richard Gere episode. That's the one we should do. But we do get this kind of period of suddenly that type of movie is like cool again. And it's not, I mean, these are all different types of, like, sword and sandal and, like, colonial action and, Rob Roy are three very different movies. But in a weird way, I think they're the kinds of movies that Hollywood probably thinks of as kind of,
I just did an episode
homecoming.
on neo swashbucklers, actually, with Dan Mecca and Connor O'Donnell a few months ago, and we were kind of talking about these going up into the Pirates of the Caribbean era, Mask of Zorro, Knight's Tale. There was this kind of period.
Yes, absolutely. And arguably it's killed off by combination of things, including like September 11th. But then in the wake of September 11th, you get like complete fantasy, right? You get total fantasy. You get the Lord of the Rings movies. The Harry Potter movies, to a certain extent, aren't really swashbucklers, but they have a bit of that.
Fantastical.
The Caribbean
Yeah.
is after that as well. But there is, it becomes like you start to get the sort of, no, there has to be like supernatural elements. There has to be effects. There has to be kind of a, almost a sci-fi Spielbergian
Yeah.
to it. And you sort of lose, I think, the things that like the movies like Last of the Mohicans and Rob Roy, and to a great extent, Braveheart and Gladiator gave us. I mean, to go back to the thing I was saying was, at the time, I thought of Gladiator as being a more serious movie that sort of flirted with schlock. But now I look back on, oh, it's total schlock. It's wonderful schlock, but like you kind of have to see it in the context of the movies Ridley Scott made later. But it's, it's gorgeous. The music is fantastic. I mean,
Oh my
immediately,
God. Yeah.
I bought the soundtrack like the day after I saw the movie.
Yeah.
And he's fantastic in it. I mean, you haven't seen Gladiator 2 yet.
No.
But I can say something about Gladiator 2, which is that, Paul Mescal, as good an actor as he is, feels totally wrong for that part to me. Not because he can't do that part, but because there is this whole thing, like there are all these scenes where, Denzel Washington is looking at him and saying that, "I see rage in you." And it's like, and it cuts to Paul Mescal, and it's just like,
Yeah,
no, you don't.
no.
There's no rage in this man,
Yeah, you need somebody. You need like another episode we did, like a Colin Farrell. You can see a little
Yeah.
rage there. Yeah.
There is a kind of, and it's not like you can sort of imagine Paul Mescal being Russell Crowe's son in a weird way. Like their features aren't that different, but there is a kind of just like, there's obviously a certain melancholy to Russell Crowe in Gladiator,
Yes.
but there is just like a savagery that just feels right. And when he unleashes, many times in the film, it just like he's perfect. He is the person to cast in this part. And I remember that script. I mean, or maybe that, I don't know if it was that script, but that project, like a Gladiator project, was hovering around Hollywood for a long time. And I think maybe even like Arnold Schwarzenegger was attached at some point, which should have keyed me into the fact that this thing is really supposed to be schlock. But Crowe in so many ways really brought that sort of unhinged action element while building a real character as a really, terrific actor. I mean, it's funny because you could, I mean, another person I could sort of see doing that part, although he just reads as much more modern, even though he did Braveheart, but Mel Gibson, kind of comes from that tradition of, oh, there's something wrong with this guy. Of course, it turned out there was something wrong with him. But there is that, I mean, the Lethal Weapon movies are a perfect example of that, where he's like, he's so charming, partly because he's crazy and like
He's
this
unhinged,
movie. And if you actually ran into this person in real life, you'd be like, oh my God, call the police, which, unfortunately happened. Russell Crowe kind of has that quality, which is also why I wonder if, as we discussed earlier, after doing these movies for a few years, he kind of stepped back a little bit and was just like, I can't do all these types of movies anymore. I wonder if he felt like he was losing it a little bit,
Yeah, I think so. I think you start getting worn thin a little bit and spread too thin, and it's just got to take a lot out of you too, the long shoots and the amount of preparation. One thing I do love rewatching Gladiator today is that, yes, you said, like, he's ripped and everything. He is, but he's not like scary Marvel era ripped, which is like this total steroided out kind of ridiculous. Like, he's more believable as like a guy who's in shape, who was a soldier, and and it fits better. You talked about the script. It was rewritten, of course, deaths in the cast and stuff. But this is one that I remember watching in our screenwriting class. That was like the first screenwriting class, and we only watched like the first act, kind of how they establish everything up until like establishing his home life, and then when things happened. And so they were pointing out how classic the setup for Gladiator mm-hmm. was, which I hadn't really put together, because I remember when I saw this the first time, I'm like, oh, it's a little new agey. And you mentioned Tony Scott, and it kind of reminds me of a Tony Scott movie I love is Deja Vu, but that's a little new agey. And so it's kind of like, you know, a little bit on that level. Yeah. But yeah, I think, you know, this one doesn't fully work as well as some of the other Russell Crowe movies and some of the other Ridley Scott movies. But now I think hearing a little bit more about Gladiator 2, of course, it's going to make it look, yes, even better. Oh, yes.
We'll see what you think.
Yeah.
Some people love it. Some people like it more than the first one. So
are you serious? Wow.
Yeah, you know, they're out there.
Yeah, whole other podcast. Yes. And then, of course, there was the Ron Howard years, A Beautiful Mind. This was back to back. He was an actor in two Best Picture winners there back to back. Beautiful Mind. And
then, a lot of people thought he was a shoo-in to win the Oscar.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember that was kind of a surprise, right?
Yeah, there was all of this controversy surrounding Beautiful Mind, like some of these things that pop up like right before the Oscars, and these different, I remember that was a pretty controversial one. And one, I liked Beautiful Mind. I think, you know, the performances are great, but Cinderella Man, I think, is very beautiful. It's a film, I remember AMC theaters at the time, I don't know if, I'm guessing it was nationwide, but I do remember there was like this initiative where, and I think it was maybe because the title wasn't drawing people in, or they didn't know what the hell this movie was, that mm-hmm. if you bought a ticket to Cinderella Man and you did not like it, you would get your money back. And so the AMC theaters were doing this. And I remember asking when I was there for a film screening, like, they said nobody had ever asked for their money back. So it is a film, like, you give it time. It's a great one, I think. You know, it's a moving story. This is a film I actually showed two Russell Crowe movies, now that I'm thinking of it. One I programmed 310 to Yuma, and this library series at Scottsdale Public Library, where I gave a lecture and we did a discussion. And then Cinderella Man was kind of like a last minute fill-in. I can't remember what I had planned, and all of a sudden we needed to change it out, and they gave me like two options, and I went with Cinderella Man. And so I just kind of had to go from memory. And yeah, everyone loved this one. It's really good. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that I vaguely remember that, you know, that AMC thing. And I think in the end, I read something about like, I mean, some people did ask for their money back. It was like
a digit number. Maybe not at the Phoenix one. People, you know,
it was like 54 people asked for their money.
Yeah.
The film underperformed
At
the time, especially being kind of like the, you know, it was going to be Ron Howard with Russell Crowe again. And it felt like a real sort of, you know, a hit, like the kind of hit that Ron Howard had specialized in up until then.
Yeah. You know?
And it might have even been an early indication that that type of movie was kind of going out the window. It's funny what happens with Cinderella Man is it's such a, I mean, it's very old fashioned, obviously. And
it is. Yes.
And I remember, like, I mean, I saw it, you know, I didn't see it in theaters. I saw it like on DVD not long after it came out, and I hadn't revisited, but I remember really liking it. Mm-hmm. And so for this podcast, I was watching it again. I bought the Blu-ray like a couple of years ago. I hadn't watched it yet. And I watched it. And I was like, what happens at the end of this? Does he win? I don't remember. And I was like, he can't possibly win, can he? Like, they don't modern movies about boxers winning. Like, I was like, I remember, like, there was something weird about the ending of this movie. And of course, he does win, but that's what was weird, because we were so, at this point,
it's supposed to be about the journey. Yes.
Yeah. But also, like, this is like for him to win, or even though Rocky doesn't win at the end of Rocky.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But like, it's seen as, the convention is seen as, oh no, like, the underdog wins, right?
Yeah.
And so you're watching and you're like, well, this can't possibly, this is too new a movie for that to have been like the thing. I mean, you're watching, oh wait, he won. That's awesome, you know?
Yeah.
It's funny, during that final fight or in the run up to that final fight, there's a scene, you know, they're intercutting between like the people at church praying, and there's a cut to like these older women praying. And I thought to myself, oh, there's no way he's going to lose this fight. Like
they went
a movie
to the old
cuts
lady.
To elderly women praying, there is no way their prayer is not going to be answered.
That'd be one dark movie. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, there was a period though while I was watching the film, when I'm like wondering, like, does Max Baer kill him? Is that what happens? Is that how this movie ends?
Yeah.
But no, it's such a good film. And I remember, you know, there was this period, I mean, because Russell Crowe was such a, you know, fiery figure, you know, obviously he broke up one Hollywood marriage, and I have it on good authority, though I guess it's not public knowledge, so I won't mention it here, that he broke up another very high profile.
Oh, yes. I think I know which one. Yeah. There was an email situation I remember hearing about. Yeah.
But there was also, you know, there was the stories about him like throwing phones at people, and
yes, I think he even talked about that on in like a 60 Minutes. Like, yeah,
right, right. I don't remember if the phone throwing incident was before Cinderella Man or after Cinderella. I think it was before. And there were also all these rumors, reports. I haven't researched these recently, but I remember at the time there were these reports that he had. That, you know, he and Ridley Scott hadn't gotten along, and that he and Howard weren't getting along. And it was kind of like, but I remember Russell Crowe during his awards campaign, either for this one or A Beautiful Mind, making a point of talking about what a man he considered Ron Howard to be, you know, and kind of like this very sort of macho, you know, you're a real man. And it's funny because I'm like, Ron Howard, you know, like
Ron Howard's movies, they're fascinating to me. And I think it goes to him being a child actor, but they're all about doing the work, kind of like Michael Mann movies, you know, procedure porn, but this is in a different way. They're all about just doing your job or supporting people in your family, like going to work. And like there are a couple scenes in this movie that, you know, I'm sure that they, you know, who knows if they're real or not. Like I haven't investigated the true story, but you know, where he returns the money that he needed for his family. He went on, you know, government assistance.
He did return the money. That I believe is true.
Yes, and scenes like that, and it does break your heart, like when he has to go and ask for money among his old colleagues. And but yeah, it's a very like pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That's the Ron Howard way, and you know. Doing everything for your family and work, you know, I mean, that's my brother, God damn it. It's Backdraft. Yes. Yeah. It's Ron Howard.
And the other thing that Ron Howard is particularly good at, is, you know, I mean, he's made a number of films that are based on true stories.
Yes.
And he's very good at, and again, I was just saying with Cinderella Man, you know, watching it again, I couldn't remember how it ended, and I was like, what's going to happen? But he is actually very good at the whole sort of, yeah, you know how the story's going to end, but I'm going to make you like actually like
get really invested,
get on the edge of your seat anyway. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, he does that with was it 13
Apollo Lives? 13 and 13 Lives.
It's
great
13
film.
Lives, right? That's the
yeah.
number. Was it 13? But yeah, because it's like,
you
I mean,
know
we all
that
watch
those
that
kids,
thing happen.
Yes.
All watch that thing happen. We absolutely
yes.
know these kids survived, and it was a heroic. We watched it happen. We saw the documentaries, but then you watch the movie, and you're just like, "Holy shit! Are they gonna make it?"
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Like, oh my god, the kid is coming too. What are we gonna do?
Yeah, like, what's he gonna do? Oh my god, you know, like, and it is. I mean, he is very good at that, and I think, I mean, look, he has a new film that hasn't come out yet, but it played at Toronto, called Eden, which I thought was quite good.
Okay.
And it's totally nuts. It's actually like the craziest Ron Howard movie I've seen. But it is, it's based on this real life story of of this of this the, this this these people that tried to start this like new civilization on an island in the middle of nowhere. And it's based on a real story. Was it the Galapagos? Is it in the Galapagos? But it's based on a true story that's been well documented. And I didn't really know the story, so for me it wasn't as much of an issue. But like I know people who know the story, who saw the film and were like really, really wondering what was going to happen, they knew what was going to happen. So he's good at that. He's very good at, well, I think what it comes down to is that he makes these films that are based on true stories, but he doesn't give them sort of a prestige movie veneer. Like he is still very much a product of like Hollywood and like of like the Spielberg era. And so he's a, his films have a kind of poppiness that sort of doesn't like takes them out of the realm of realism, like historical realism. Like you start to enjoy them just as like a movie. Like the people stop feeling like real characters. They
Yeah, a
stop.
little bit. Yeah.
I mean, not that they don't feel real, but they stop feeling like people who really existed because he's so good at just making it all seem so kind of, I mean, he Hollywoodizes the stories, but
Yes.
not in a bad way for the most part. Like he Hollywoodizes, like he has a flair for just like the sensationalized, and he has a flair for spectacle, and he has a flair for just kind of, very quick, clean character lines and things like that, which then makes you enjoy the movie or experience the movie really as just like, a very poppy story that's happening before your eyes, as opposed to something out of history. So you stop thinking of it as history,
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a really great film. I'm glad that you mentioned this one. We were kind of going back and forth on like which Ron Howard movie we should do, but I was glad. This is another one
I
with
don't
the
love a
beautiful
beautiful.
score, Thomas Newman. And this, this was also around the time of Road to Perdition, another Thomas Newman score. They even kind of look alike, the way that they're shot and the era. So those are two films you could watch kind of in tandem as well. And then jumping ahead, we've got Crow Being Funny. And I think, we knew he was kind of a funny guy, but we knew he was funny more on his talk show appearances and some of that. But I love seeing him in The Nice Guys, which is kind of one of those movies that Twitter is obsessed with. I prefer Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, but Nice Guys is a blast. Russell Crowe, Ryan Gosling, Shane Black. So talk to me about The Nice Guys.
I mean, the nice guys is delightful. I mean, obviously, we know now that Ryan Gosling is a comic genius.
Yes.
I mean,
He kind of
recognized as
needed to
such, thanks
like
to
ease into
Barbie.
that a bit. Yeah. Like he was a serious guy and he still can do serious, but I think he just kind of realized he could have a little more fun.
I mean, I think people forget. He was seen as such a serious actor. Like he was seen as like really like, I mean, it's almost like when Ed Norton first came onto the scene, it was this kind of like, oh, this guy's like a real thing and he's really intense. And he's kind of got an intense face. He's got the tiny mouth, And
They forget the Mickey Mouse Club and stuff, but yes.
yeah, that's the thing though. But that's the thing, is like the Mickey Mouse Club almost seemed like a weird anomaly because
Yeah,
he
for
was
him
like
and Carrie
doing,
Russell and a bunch of them.
right, because he was doing, I mean, he did The Believer, obviously, but like, Blue Valentine. I mean, he was
Yeah.
seen as like the
Place Beyond the Pines.
right. Like he was really seen as kind of like intense, kind of brooding. Like I said, tiny mouth. I actually think the tiny mouth really helps with comedy, but at the time it was kind of like, Ryan Gosling. And like it turns out, like really he should just be doing comedies,
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he's obviously a very good actor. He can do whatever the hell he wants. But like, you probably know I'm a huge fan of the Fall Guy, and I'm just like, this is, I just want him to make Fall Guy movies for the next 10 years. But the Nice Guys is kind of like that too. It's kind of like, oh gosh, like please make like 10 of these, you know?
He's got this kind of like Burt Reynolds-y kind of thing you can see between this and Fall Guy, and just having
But
fun.
it is funny though, if you told me in, I don't know, like, when was Ryan Gosling, when did Ryan Gosling first kind of emerge, you know?
There was, oh, what was that movie with Sandra Bullock, Murder by Numbers?
Right,
And there
right,
was
right.
the Fracture era.
Right,
There was,
right. So it's like 20.
The aughts, I guess.
Aughts, right? So if you told me, like, in the middle of the aughts that one day there would be one of my favorite comedies would star Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling, I'd be like,
Yes.
what? People do comedy? What are you talking
Yes.
about? But one thing I do really love about The Nice Guys is, you know, obviously it starts off as Russell Crowe is kind of the veteran, you know, investigator, who really kind of knows what he's doing and knows his way around things. And then Ryan Gosling, complete incompetent. But as the movie proceeds, Crowe's character actually, like Gosling's incompetence rubs off on Crowe.
Yes, very
starts
much.
To be like a complete fucking klutz. I love the way the movie switches that stuff around. I mean, you're sort of watching Gosling become more of a, you know, a more confident, capable person. Like, you know, in his kind of ramshackle way, you're sort of watching that happen over the course of the movie. But really, you're also watching Russell Crowe just start to fuck things up.
Shane Black loves doing that with his duos. He always likes duos that bring out the opposite in each other, and they kind of change roles as the thing continues. I mean, Lethal Weapon, but even stuff like Long Kiss Goodnight, and just some of, you know, these characters kind of merge or bring out the opposite in each other.
And Crowe is good at that too. I mean, it's funny. I mean, we're talking about this movie, obviously. But, you know, there are a number of movies he's done where he's part way, you know. I mean, Master and Commander is an example of that. But like, there are, like, he's made a number of films, or American Gangster. You know, he's made, The Insider, obviously. But, like, he in some ways thrives in that kind of environment where he can be a type that then is played off against another type. I mean, in The Insider, we talked about, you know, he's kind of so inward, and then Pacino is so outward, and Pacino is so vague, and Crowe is so restrained. And ordinarily you would say, well, these two people feel like they're in different movies, but man is so good with tone that it feels like a whole ecosystem that he's
And you actually need that balance for sure.
Like, I think Crowe is really good at that. Like, I think Crowe should make more movies where it's like him and somebody else, either a buddy movie or like they're chasing each other or something. Like very good.
Where he's holding up his half.
I mean, The Nice Guys is wonderful, and, you know, I wish it was a bigger hit.
And yes, I do agree with you. We should have a few of these by now, for sure.
Yeah, and they could, you know.
Yeah.
If the film has enough of a cult following at this point that...
I know, and it keeps getting more popular. Yeah.
Gosling loved doing it, if I understand correctly. So it's almost like you'd have to, I mean, you know, he'd be the key. Like, if you can get him to do it, I can't imagine Russell Crowe wouldn't want to do it.
No. From what I understand, he had a blast doing this movie. And this is one I also just love the actors that show up. I mean, all of these movies we're talking about, like with Cinderella Man, we had Paul Giamatti gives a remarkable performance, other actors in these movies. But in Nice Guys, you know, people like Margaret Qualley, I love Matt Bomer in this because it's so unexpected from what you would expect. Matt Bomer, Kim Basinger shows up in this movie. So that's kind of a fun little, you know, nod, a little wink at the audience. Keith David. It's just, I think this is great. And they could easily make more of these. Yes. And I think this era too, we started to see Crowe in some, was it The Kelly Gang, that movie? Like, we started to see different sides of Russell Crowe, even in some of these sort of, I mean, back in the day, we would have said direct to disc, or these straight to streaming, or these not that spectacular, like Land of Bad. he's good in it.
Which I still haven't seen. I've heard great things about that.
Yeah, it's not a, you know, masterpiece, but he's good in it. It's kind of cool to see him embracing all of these different sides of himself, because he can modulate tone and, you know, he has a lot of range. Yeah.
He's got tremendous range. I mean, he's a really great, you know, not just a great actor. I mean, we know he's a great actor, but he's mm-hmm. also someone who seems to have really thought about what it means to be an actor and an artist. Yeah. There was a speech. I was trying to find it before we went on. I couldn't find it because it was something that somebody had shared on Twitter. And I remember I retweeted it. It was like 2 years ago, in December 2022. And it was Russell Crowe giving some kind of introduction at an award ceremony. And this got shared all over the place, but it was such a sweet and thoughtful speech that he was giving. And I'm trying to find it because I'm just like, I need to hear it again. But you got the sense. And he was like the head of the Australian Actors Association at the time, the ACTA, I think. So he was kind of like, he wasn't just like randomly riffing on acting. He had to give a speech. Mm-hmm. So somebody probably helped him write it. But it was such a thoughtful and moving celebration of acting. And you got the sense that here was a man who really, really cares about the work of an actor. And you know, it felt like a bit of a switch because earlier in his career, because he kind of wound up in tabloids so often, he seemed to be such a sort of intense, slightly deranged person, that like you forget that these people are actually like really serious about their craft.
Yeah.
And in some cases, the reason they are kind of crazy is because they are serious about their
craft. Yes, exactly.
I mean, Sean Penn is kind of like that. I mean, Sean Penn is kind of a, by the way, happily do a Sean Penn episode with you, but like,
oh my God, I would love to. Yeah.
He's one of these guys. He's kind of become a joke now. And I mean, he goes on CNN and sounds like he just smoked like 30 cigarettes, but like Sean Penn in his day was very serious about acting.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And these are people who really, really, really care.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it when it shows, you know, because there is, I mean, with public figures, especially, there is this fear of being seen to care too much. Mm-hmm. But I love it when somebody reveals themselves to not like, not worry about that, not worry about that.
They're earnest about it. Yeah.
Yeah. They're willing to be earnest, and they don't feel the need to act like this is just the thing that kind of happened. You know, the way.
I just fell into it and I got lucky.
I just threw it. I'm just so brilliant that I can just stumble into acting and suddenly win Oscar.
Yeah.
And you know, with these people like, no.
I worked hard.
We worked very hard at this for a very long time. And we think about it all the time because, I mean, that's actually something that people should be able to relate to, like, you know, whatever you're doing in life, you know, like, oh, right. Hard work is actually like something that pays off sometimes, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it definitely did here. And before we logged on and started recording, you were talking about how Russell Crowe has been in so many movies that you didn't have time to rewatch, of course, because you're very busy and you write so many brilliant pieces. But looking at his filmography, are there any films you want to make sure people seek out, maybe that you want to watch again in the future, now that you're kind of going down the Crowe rabbit hole?
Well, I think we briefly mentioned 310 to Yuma.
Yes.
Which I
don't
love.
Know. Have I told you the story where I showed this?
You mentioned
this...
it a little bit, but tell me the full story.
Okay. Yeah. I showed the film, and it was mostly with the Scottsdale. It was by a bunch of nursing homes. And so we were like the activity on a Sunday. And there's a scene in the movie where he is staring very intently with lust at a female barmaid. And this woman watching it, this older woman, like forgot to breathe for a second and started coughing so hard, and she actually like had to get up and leave the auditorium. And I'm like, oh my God. So I followed to make sure she was okay. And I'm like, are you okay? She's like, that man, just, you know, and it just kind of shows you the difference in he knows how to do that. And it was all nonverbal. And, you know, of course, it's Russell Crowe. He knows how to pick up a woman. But yeah, it just kind of shows you the difference between the genders and how that played. So, yes, that movie is great. But
In terms of films, I mean, like I said, 310 to Yuma is a really good film, and
Yeah, it's a great Western.
I am actually a fan of James Mangold,
Yeah, me
and I
too.
feel like he's a guy who doesn't get the respect he should.
I'm
I
a
mean, yes,
huge Night and Day person, but yeah.
I'm not the biggest fan of Night and Day, but I'm like, he's made some clunkers, but he's made mostly very good films. I mean, looking over his career, there's so many films where he shows up and I'm like, well, he's really good. The movie isn't so great, oh gosh. I mean, Thor Love and Thunder is terrible, but he's delightful in it, The
I
greatest
have
beer
not
run ever
seen
is,
the Pope's movies. Are they entertaining?
They're entertaining. They're not good. But I mean, it's one. I guess they're going to do a sequel, but The Pope's Exorcist, he's actually a lot of fun in The Pope's Exorcist. The movie kind of forgets to have as much fun as he's having. Like, the
All
movie takes
right.
a little too seriously. But it's totally worth seeing. I mean, that could very well be a movie. Look, I had to review it. I was looking forward to it, and I was ready to have like a goofy good time, and I didn't quite have a goofy good time. But it's entirely possible that if I watch it again, I might have a better time than I did when I first saw it. Noah, he's very good. I mean, Noah is in some ways. I mean, the nice guys obviously we really like, but Noah is kind of. I mean, is it like maybe his last true great performance in like a big space
Yeah,
movie?
I don't
You know,
know.
like after
Probably.
that. After that, it's kind of a lot of like, I mean, The Water Diviner, he directed, so like
Yeah.
he had other, it's not a great movie, but like he had other things on his mind. But like, I don't think I've seen Fathers and Daughters, but
No.
and it's like, I mean, The Mummy is terrible, and we make a lot of jokes about the Dark Universe and how it flopped. I do feel like it would have been fun to see a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde movie with Russell Crowe. That's what they were saying.
Ooh.
Because that's who he plays in that movie, is almost like, it's not a cameo, but it's kind of a, it's like the moments in that movie where they're like starting to build their universe. And I'm thinking, well, this movie is terrible, but I kind of want it to be a hit because I sort of need my Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde movie with Russell Crowe, because that would be a great Russell Crowe, Like, somebody should just do that,
Yeah.
I mean,
We're
that's,
just throwing out ideas here. I love this.
I mean,
More
Dr.
nice
Jekyll and
guys, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Yeah.
Jekyll and Hyde is, I'm pretty sure, in the public domain. Like, you could go and
Yeah.
make a movie like that with Russell Crowe like today if you really want to,
Yeah.
because that's who he played in that, right? So.
Yeah. Well, Bilge, I want to thank you so much for doing this, for talking about Russell Crowe. You came up with some great ideas for more actors we need to talk about. So, let's shorten the list because,
Sure.
otherwise I'll keep you there all year and you'll have to come back. Yeah. So I
I would
appreciate
love
it.
to. I would love to.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun, and it was really fun revisiting these Russell Crowe movies. It is, he is. There was that brief period when Russell Crowe was like the biggest actor in the world, and it was
Yes.
like we didn't know how good we had it,
We did not. Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't have these huge movie stars anymore at this level. Yeah.
I mean,
We have some,
we
but
have
yeah.
good actors, and we have, but it is, I mean, it was kind of the last gasp of like,
Yeah, of the kind of films that we were making too.
mainstream
Yeah.
serious movie making with like big stars and big budgets,
Yeah.
and that kind of had space to breathe, and people spent time making them, and they spent money making them. We have some of those movies now, but they don't really spend a lot of time making them, and it's funny, they spend a lot of money, but there's somehow like, I'm like, what? Maybe you should have spent more money. I don't know. Like,
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't really look like you spent that much, but I don't know. But yeah, so
Yes. No, this was great. Thank you so much.
thank you. This was great.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.